Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin leads the nation in the production of specialty cheeses, accounting for 47% of the total? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show tracing the stories behind your favorite Asian dishes. I'm your host, Linda Liu. We are broadcasting live from Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every episode, we dig deep on a dish or an aspect of Asian cuisine, and we interview experts on the topic. Okay, so hashtag FMW Asian Breakfast is back in a big way this season. Last week, we talked about Beijing's jianbing. This week, we're on to Taiwan's famous breakfast. For those who haven't had the pleasure of experiencing it yet, the typical Taiwanese breakfast consists of a decent amount of carbs and various forms of bings and porridge. And there's some options for proteins and eggs to be added to your carbs, too. And all of it is usually washed down by a hot glass or bowl of soy milk. If you want to try it out in NYC, you can head on over to Zai Lai, a home-style Taiwanese concept in Columbus Circle's Turnstile Market. Zai Lai, meaning come back soon in Mandarin, aims to deliver the comfort and hospitality of a home-cooked family meal to on-the-go commuters. And here in the studio with me is chef of Zai Lai, Edward Huang. Chef Edward's curiosity about food began in elementary school when he learned that not everybody ate rice for dinner. After college, Chef Edward traveled back to his roots, spending a couple years in Taiwan, exploring his family heritage and eating his way across the island. Edward has worked in kitchens from Taiwan to Manhattan, including staging at James Kitchen in Taipei, Feng Chu in the Lower East Side, and most recently at Mission Chinese Food. Welcome to the show, Edward.
It's good to be here, Linda. Thanks for having me. I'm a big fan.
Oh, thank you. And even on this snowy nor'easter day,
we made it. It's cold out there, but it's warm in here.
Okay, so before we dig into it, sometimes we like to start our show with, what's the best thing you ate recently? And I'll go first, so you have a second to think about it, Edward.
Sure.
But yesterday, because I was getting provisions for the nor'easter, again, like a big fat lie, with the weather forecast anyways, I got an awesome Korean burrito at Bulbap Grill, which is in my hood in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. It came with this like soft, almost sticky cilantro lime rice, lettuce and cheese with sweet, juicy bulgogi wrapped in a tortilla. And it was just a great fusion dish. So what about you, Edward? What have you been eating?
Well, I was recently home in California, so I had the privilege of eating my mom's home-cooked food.
Oh, best.
So it's hard to beat. So my mind immediately went to that. She did something newer. She did a scallop dish that she stir-fried with snow peas, some broccoli, some mushrooms.
And paired with rice.
Paired with rice, yeah.
Oh, so fresh, so home-cooked.
Yeah,
sounds really great.
Every time I go home, I need to take notes so I can have new items on our menu.
Yeah, there you go. Your inspo is mom. Okay, so going back to your bio, where did you move to and from when you realized not everybody ate rice for dinner?
Well, I was in California at the time. I can actually picture
it. Like what part?
Oh, Southern California.
Okay.
In a place called Fountain Valley.
Uh-huh.
And I can picture it. I was in the front yard with one of my neighbors, Matt Benson, and
What an American name.
Yeah. Obviously non-Asian. I don't even know how we started talking about it. I think I was pretty young, maybe like first or second grade.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me that they were having potatoes and bread for dinner. And I said, what?
Yeah, was like your first food conversation where there was a clear difference.
Yeah. It's like that moment as a kid when you realize like the chicken is chicken.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're like, whoa, that's mind-blowing, but it makes sense. Or also that I remember a moment when I was older, actually, when I realized that American restaurants serve fish without bones.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I was really proud of my, you know, bone fish picking skills.
Of course.
From my childhood.
With the chopsticks.
Yeah, with the chopsticks. So that was another sort of small but mind-blowing sort of moment.
So it was kind of just, you know, being so integrated with your like family food culture,
yeah,
that when you stepped out of it, growing up as a kid, like step by step, you see all these differences, even in, you know, California.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because I think my mom made it a point to cook dinner every single night. So that was just normal for me. So anything else, I think it was fun for me to explore and see what was normal for everyone else.
Yeah. What a American Chinese story.
Totally.
So what kind of food did you eat growing up? And because we're talking about breakfast, what did you eat for breakfast?
So growing up, I just mentioned my mom would make it a point to cook every night. And I really love that. And I think that's a lot of where the culture of Zai Lai comes from, is the sense of eating together as a family. I remember as a kid, I was a little whiny, so I'd always complain about wanting fast food and wanting to go out. But I think now as an adult, I'm so grateful that was something that my mom made it a point to do. I mean,
and she's from Taiwan.
Yes, she's from Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's the inspiration behind much of Zai Lai's food and the dishes and the culture.
So what about the breakfast part?
So the breakfast part, I mean, this is suburban California, so it was pretty boring. I just eat cereal most of the time, to be honest.
That's where the American comes in, of the Chinese American.
Exactly. But I mean, one of the things that we serve is a rice porridge. And I remember that being a really memorable highlight of childhood breakfast for me. I mean, for us, there would be so many fun and wonderful sides. I mean, I would eat the century egg, the pi dan, with the pork floss and the tofu and a little bit of soy sauce over it, or the fermented bean curd, or the salted duck egg, or the pickled cucumbers, or God forbid now, I mean, it was straight up gluten with peanut. I mean, I guess hearing myself say these things, it doesn't sound that appetizing, but it was really tasty.
Mm-hmm. It's like the color, the different textures and all of that too, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so in your words, how would you describe Taiwanese breakfast? What are the typical components?
I feel like you did a pretty good job of describing Taiwanese breakfast. I mean, it's
the carb heaviness.
Carb heavy. I mean, in that way, it's very similar to American breakfast, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Carb heavy, egg heavy, and you know, generally washed down with a cup or a bowl of soy milk.
Yeah. That's spot on. So what would you say are like the key differences then between Taiwanese and U.S. breakfast, if there's like those like egg and carb similarities?
Yeah, that's a good question, Linda. I recently read an article put out by the New York Times about how much sugar is in American breakfast.
Oh.
How American breakfast in a lot of ways should be more, you know, designated as dessert rather than breakfast. So I would say that Taiwanese breakfast, I mean, Taiwanese people generally don't like things as sugary, as sweet. So
mm-hmm. Taiwanese unless breakfast, it's specifically dessert.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even then, I think it's less sweet than American
Got
dessert.
It.
But a lot of Taiwanese breakfast, for that reason, won't have all the extra sugar in there. For example, the soy milk, and we do this at Zai Lai, is our soy milk is three ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
It's water, it's soybeans, and it's a little bit of sugar. I think soy milk in the U.S. is it just tastes different. There's preservatives, it lasts a lot longer, but it doesn't have that freshness. It doesn't mm-hmm. have that that fullness of flavor, that, you know, that, I don't know, that raw soy flavor.
Like in Taiwan, they're making it to be, you know, consumed day of in like the next few hours or something like that, right?
So, yeah, exactly.
Okay, so what is the deal with soy milk and having that be like the preeminent, you know, beverage item in Taiwanese breakfast? Why is it so popular?
I mean, it's so good. I mean, and if our listeners haven't had Taiwanese soy milk, then I'd like to invite you over to try some Taiwanese soy milk. It's very different than American soy milk, but I think it also goes so well with the different carbs or eggs. You know, just a little bit of sweetness, like a savory warm. And I guess it's similar to how U.S. breakfast, you know, you can wash it down with a glass of milk. It's similar to that. But
is it because there's a lot of lactose intolerant Asians?
I'm sure that's a big piece of it too. Well, and I think there's been a lot of myths about soy milk that have been popularized. Maybe not so much recently, but
like
in the last
what?
Like 10 years, about the, I think the a connection with soy milk or cancer or breast cancer specifically, or to soy milk or soy products and decreased testosterone. I think those are all, I don't know, just myths that are not
around
proved
soy.
To be true around soy.
Okay.
So people will avoid soy purposely, not realizing that some of their conceptions of soy and the soy milk aren't necessarily true.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's maybe because also it's like a big produce item that's produced in Taiwan, in the China region, and it's made into soy milk, but also soy sauce and whatever else, right?
Yeah. Well, and soy milk actually, I guess similar to milk, it's really high in protein. So it's a good way to start the day.
Mm, great alternative to milk, guys. So what are the stars of your Zai Lai breakfast menu? Let's talk about what you have on there.
It's funny, as I think about it, I don't know if this ever happened to you, Linda, when you were a kid, when your parents would pull you up to other kids and go back to back and like measure to see who's taller. Like that's what this feels like. Oh, which is fine. I mean, I was a younger kid, so I'd love it. I'd try to like, you know, be taller. My brother hated it because, you know, he was older and I was constantly trying to catch up. But so that's a little what this feels like, but we can do it. It's okay. Mm-hmm. One of the big stars is our rice porridge, mm-hmm. which I've been really pleasantly surprised by. I mean, it's nice for me just because I have so many childhood memories of eating rice porridge with my parents, you know, and so it's such a pleasure to share that with New York. I thought that it wouldn't be as popular just because it's lesser known. Mm-hmm. It's not. I don't know where I could get Taiwanese rice porridge in the city, honestly, aside from Zai Lai, and I'm sure there's places out there, but it's not, you know, it's not something that's on the radar of a lot of people, mm-hmm. especially if they aren't eating a lot of Taiwanese food. So the fact that I think people are trying it out, and we have some regulars that will come and eat it almost every day. They just love it. So I've really enjoyed sharing that dish.
Yeah, what have they said about it? Why do they love it so much?
I think it's in some ways it's a analog to oatmeal, right? It's like mm-hmm. a bowl of warm, soft textured food.
It's like comforting. It's soul food.
Yeah. I think it's so comforting. We serve ours with our sous vide egg, and we kind of like I had in my childhood. I had my choice of sides, so we also allow people to just add on, you know, whatever and however many sides that they want.
Oh yeah,
to
I
add.
Went to Zai Lai, totally took advantage of the condiments bar. That pork floss was just like getting dumped on there, but like so good.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's the customization too. I
think so. Yeah, I think people can decide, and it's a lot of really healthy vegetables too. You know, it's a different way to start the day, and it's less carb heavy than some of the other bread based breakfast products.
So what are those?
So our biggest seller is definitely the scallion pancake. I think everyone knows, or
yeah,
not everyone
familiar.
But, yeah, like people
Chinese
know what a scallion
product,
pancake
yeah.
is. For breakfast, we serve it with an egg in there, so a little bit of protein. It's familiar. It's soft. It's flaky. It's
you grab and go.
Grab and go. It's easy. Another item is our sesame flatbread, This one is traditionally served with something called a youtiao. It's saobing youtiao, and it's like a fried cruller, like a soft, chewy donut, for lack of a better description.
But in a long stick form.
In a long stick form, exactly. I mean, at Xylai, and I think in my family history, we try to be a little more healthy, so we don't deep fry anything, so we don't serve that, even though that, I guess, is more a more iconic Taiwanese breakfast.
Okay.
But we serve ours with egg, and then I guess this is a more sort of Americanized piece, where my mom would sometimes give us some bacon with it, so we serve ours with some bacon too.
Oh, there's the twist. So do you feel like the menu will be changing or expanding, or you're gonna kind of stick with these options first?
That's a good question. I think a lot of it's been really fun to see how many people have really come around us with Taiwanese food, and everyone always has like these suggestions. Oh, we should put this on the menu, put that on the menu, and I'm with them. I think all of these different suggestions are great. The current limitation is how small our kitchen is. I mean, you've been there, you've seen it. We've maxed it out. We have.
It's like the size of the HRN studio, but maybe smaller even.
Yeah, 300 square feet. And I mean, we came from pop-up, so I think it was three times the size of a pop-up. We were like, oh, this is going to be amazing.
You're growing,
it's going to be huge.
Right?
Yeah, but now it's, we just don't have enough kitchen space for other. I mean, we'll continually experiment, and we have some breakfast specials sort of like in our back pocket that I'm thinking about and trying to figure out when I want to bring those out. But I think we are limited by space. So I guess to really answer that question, we'll just have to figure out when we'll be able to expand.
Very cool. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more Feast Meets West.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Satori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Feast Meets West. So, Edward, what inspired you to open Xylai? And I guess, like, second part of that question is, did you know you were going to open Xylai? Like, when was that moment?
those are great questions. What inspired me to open the restaurant, I think, is really the hospitality piece. Like I mentioned, my mom is a big piece of the inspiration for this. And we would just, I didn't know that this wasn't normal at the time. My mom would just invite over, you know, people and just have family parties. And this would be like every week, every weekend, we would go somewhere or some people would come over and we just eat together. And that was a really formative piece of my childhood growing up, is, you know, just being around people, eating together consistently over time. And I think that hospitality piece, wanting to provide a space where people can do that, right? I think as I thought about it, the root word of hospitality is actually hospital. It's a place of healing and a place of restoration. And my inspiration and reason for wanting to do Xylai was really wanting to offer a place like that to New Yorkers.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really great. So in terms of getting into food, though, you know, like working in the kitchen, was that your like 4-year old self talking to Matt when that idea came up, or was it through, you know, your experience in college or like the traveling after?
That's a great question. I think at some point, I don't know exactly when this happened, but there was a point where it was just in me where I almost felt like I couldn't not do it. So I think that's part of it. But I think very practically too, I recognized after coming back from Taiwan that I rarely ate Taiwanese food or Chinese food out just because I couldn't get what I wanted. And so I think part of me was saying, hey, like there's... The market's missing something. It's missing this really good Taiwanese food, and maybe I can, you know, play a part in bringing that.
Mm-hmm. Would you say you like kind of staged by your mom's side along the way as you grew up, or are you kind of like after experiencing Taiwan and eating across the island, you kind of like circled back to her and be like, "Mom, teach me everything."
It was definitely much more of the circling back. I think I didn't have the self-awareness or the maturity as a kid to I don't know, just be grateful for, you know, for all that my mom did and how committed she was.
Yeah. So, yeah, talking about the mission of Zailai, providing that Taiwanese social aspect, the hospitality, what's the reception so far?
It's been much stronger than I expected, which has been a very pleasant surprise. The Taiwanese community has really come around us in a very, I don't know, just in a very encouraging way. I think mm-hmm. people are just hungry for Taiwanese food. And I guess when they haven't had it in so long, they're just like, yes, you're here, you're open, thank you. We've had some stories where, actually, I met someone this past week even, where I think she's lived in New York. She said she's lived in New York longer than I've been alive. So it's been a while. And she was just so grateful to have Taiwanese food. She said, "I'm going to tell everyone about this." And she ate with us, and then she came back and bought some more for her kids so that her kids could try it and just have Taiwanese food. I think there's such a rich cultural heritage among Taiwanese people, and not having an expression or an ability to step into that through food, I think is it's hard. To be a culture that values food so much and yet isn't able to enjoy it regularly. So I think people have really responded to us.
Yeah, that's awesome. And what about for non-Asians?
For non-Asians, most non-Asians have been really, really supportive as well. I think much more than I expected. We've had this huge, just groundswell of support of people saying, hey, this is kind of like Chinese food, but it's not, it's different. But I like it. It's so fresh. These flavors are great. They're different. I mean, like everything, there's always going to be people that love it and some people that don't like it. And that's just some part of everything that we do.
Yeah. I also feel like your placement, you know, it's like a commuter hub.
Yeah.
Your position to expose Taiwanese food to all sorts of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, from a pop-up at Madison Square Eats, right?
Yeah,
to
right.
Now permanent home at the Turnstile Market. You know, what have you learned so far? What are some milestones, challenges, or like surprises along the way?
One big surprise was from our first pop-up to finally opening this location, it took us 3.5 years.
That sounds kind of like a long time, I guess, right? Is that what that is?
Yeah, it's just... Opening a restaurant in New York City is just a really hard journey. Mm-hmm. And I, when I first started, I don't think I was prepared for how hard it was going to be. As a small business, you just have to do a little bit of everything. You have to try out food. And it's not just the food. It's the small business aspect. It's the raising money. It's everything. I think without the support of my wife, I don't know that I would be around, to be very honest. I mean, and also... I'm not saying this for pity points, but the sort of praise criticism ratio is not equal. Mm-hmm. I'll just say it that way, right? And I mean, and maybe this is a funny way of saying it, but I feel like in Taiwanese culture, people are very quick to tell you how you can improve. This is sort of
very like blunt in a way, maybe
very, very blunt. This is sort of like the A minus isn't good enough. You know, sort of.
Oh, that's so funny. I saw on your Instagram stories today. Congratulations. You got a grade A from the food department. But you're like, mom would be like, where's A plus?
Exactly. I actually, this is a funny experience with my mom. We were eating in Din Tai Fung, which is probably one of the most well-recognized soup dumpling restaurants in the world, right? Like, hugely successful, incredible food, Michelin stars, everything. And my mom looks around and she says, oh, if you can do something like this, that'd be good.
You're like, what?
And I was like, mom, this is like some of the best food in the world. I mean, I want to, you know, hopefully we get there, but that's, you know, that's sort of the environment that I find myself
in. Aim for the stars always.
Exactly. And so I think it, the time and the difficulty, I think it's been so hard, but I think it's been hugely helpful in sort of developing myself as a person, finding my identity, recognizing that, you know, my report card or how I do, my success doesn't define me as a person. And I think that's maybe a very Asian American, I mean, it's probably a very universal sort of idea, but I think it was a huge experience that I'm grateful for, coming through and recognizing, hey, when I'm not producing, when I'm not, you know, making a whole bunch of money, like, my wife still loves me. The people around me still love me.
You get to do what you love.
Yeah. So it's, I think because it took so long, it's so much more satisfying. Like that day that we opened, I was so nervous. I like wanted to cry, but it was so satisfying to finally get there. And I feel like the stories we have these days in terms of startups and entrepreneurs and all that, it's all instant success. It's all, oh, they're 20 years old and they're a billionaire. And mm-hmm. and I feel like,
well,
there's so much.
Well, that's the stories that like media floats up to the top. So it's really easy to be like sidetracked by that, but it's not reality.
It's not reality. And I'm really grateful just for, I don't know, the life experience that I've had in opening this restaurant. And in that way, being able to better care for my staff, to set realistic expectations, to... I know my business partners have been with me from the beginning, and we actually had a conversation where at one point I was like, I don't know if I can do this. Maybe I just need to return whatever money we have and just, you know, I'm sorry, I've lost you money. And for them to say, hey, I believe in you and I believe in Xyli and I believe in what you're doing, you know, go for it. You know, that's like... That's worth much more than, you know, that experience is so much more valuable than being an instant success in my eyes.
Wow, that's so amazing. Well, again, Craig, congratulations on that journey. I mean, it's such a learning process. Another aspect I wanted to cover off on is, you know, the home style concept of Xyli. You know, like everyone has different definitions of home style. Have you gotten that feedback from some of your customers?
Yeah, it's the word home style is so much more polarizing than I expected.
Yeah, and also maybe like especially for Taiwanese food.
I suppose so. I mean, in some ways, home style in Taiwan is almost a lost art. I mean, everyone, food in Taiwan is so cheap that it's so easy to eat out that a lot of people aren't cooking. There's this new generation of people that aren't cooking anymore. So people are looking to parents and grandparents for those home style flavors that aren't as prevalent anymore, which is really interesting in my mind. But I guess in Taiwan also, there's such a, just like in the US, right? There's different regions with different emphases on different vegetables or different types of flavors. Like in the South, it's a little sweeter. In the North, it's a little cleaner. And some of these differences, I guess when I put home style, I was thinking my home style, but I guess for some people, it's not their home style. And I guess that's what can be harder.
Yeah, especially if they're in Taiwanese and so excited to see this first Taiwanese restaurant in like a Manhattan location. They're like, what? But that's still super cool. And one thing we've also noticed here at Feast Meets West, and we've been so fortunate to have some of your Taiwanese food peers on the show. So the guys from Winsun,
so
Boba
cool.
Guys,
yeah.
And later this season, Rich from Ho Foods.
Yeah.
Why do you think that it's been in the last 2-3 years maybe that the Taiwanese food movement has become somewhat louder?
That's a really good question. That's something that I've been thinking about more. I think there's two reasons. I think one is, I think New Yorkers recognize good food when they have it. And I think that there's so much, Taiwan has such a strong food culture that as that is starting to be, I guess, displayed in New York, I think people are recognizing it and they're enjoying it. And that's been really, really promising. I think another reason is really the immigration story. A lot of the original Taiwanese restaurateurs have sort of aged out of restaurants. I don't know if people have noticed, but it's harder to find really, you know, good Taiwanese food. Even in Flushing, it's harder to find. It's a lot less prevalent than it was before. People mm-hmm. have, you know, it's sort of the American dream where Taiwanese families, the first generation immigrants, have sacrificed to make a better opportunity for their kids, and their kids have become professionals, and they're not interested in running these restaurants anymore, and so they're slowly closing. So it's just harder. I think in general, it's harder to find Taiwanese food.
Yeah, like the art isn't passed down from generation to generation
exactly.
here as kids become lawyers and doctors. And
exactly. I mean, I you know, I'm a lawyer, so you know, that's part of my background. But I think there's something, I don't know, incredibly beautiful about, I guess, this, what you describe as, you know, this I don't know, a new wave of Taiwanese entrepreneurs that are interested in saying, hey, this food is really good. Let's present it to the world. And it's been a really huge privilege to be a part of that.
Also, hold up. I didn't know you were also a lawyer. That's amazing. Okay, so lawyer chef. When did you make that, like, switch over?
I made the switch over. Well, I had the distinct honor of graduating in 2010, right when there were 3 years of unemployed lawyers from the recession.
Oh, God.
So some of it was an accident. I mean, my first job out of law school, I did catering in law school to make some extra money.
Mm-hmm.
And my first job out of law school, besides an internship I was doing, I was, you know, I helped a chef open a restaurant. And I just enjoyed it. I just thought it was fun. And it ended up being really valuable experience for me opening my restaurant.
Oh my God, that's so great. Of course, from lemons, you make lemonade. So what do you hope and project for the future of Taiwanese breakfast and Taiwanese food in the U.S.?
So I'm a big superhero fan. So I saw Black Panther recently, and beyond just a good superhero movie, I've been really stoked to see what Black Panther is doing, rightly so, for the Black community and just projecting a sense of pride in who the Black community is. And if anything, what I'd love to see is Taiwanese people, Chinese people, Asians, that as they see more, you know, of Asian food, Taiwanese food out there, that they would also take a sense of pride in their heritage and in who they are as Taiwanese Americans.
That's awesome. Okay, so last question. What's next for you and Zai Lai?
That's one that I don't know, that I
think
about
often. I know you just
often.
Opened. You literally just opened, what, last year?
Yeah,
in the permanent location.
We've been open for 3 months in our location. We've actually been doing, you know, providentially way better than we projected. So that's a great sign. So we're starting to think about expansion. And so we're looking at that. A Zai Lai noodle bar could be really fun. One of the things that I'm dreaming of right now, and this is still really early, I guess you'll hear it here first, is I would love to help organize a Taiwanese food festival.
Ooh.
With some of these peers that we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to get together and we're starting to just talk and dream. And I think that'd be so much fun.
Mm-hmm. That's really incredible. Well, you know, I'll definitely be there. You have our support. And that just about wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for joining us, Edward.
It was so much fun. Thanks for having me, Linda.
So what's the best way for our listeners to stay up to date on news from Zai Lai?
Our Instagram handle is @ZailaiNYC. That's ZailaiNYC. You can also follow us on Facebook.
Awesome. And you'll be sharing some of those surprise breakfast items there?
They'll definitely go on Instagram as soon as they come out.
Cool. And for you listeners out there, did you enjoy this episode? If so, please leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. It'll go a long way getting others to listen and discover the show. And we'll be back next week with another awesome conversation from the world of Asian food.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.